the capital nature or capital crime of the events that took place in Gibeah, in Benjamin, about the sodomy and rape. And whereas the Sodomites in Gibeah, when they ravished and raped the Levite's concubine, was that a capital crime? And I said in class on Sunday that I thought it was, but I couldn't think of any passages. Just real quickly, look at Leviticus 18, and we'll do this in short order. Leviticus chapter 18, starting in verse 22. Here's what the law said about sodomites or sodomy. Leviticus 18 and verse 22. You shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It is an abomination. Now, there's no mention there of death. Drop down to verse 29. This list in Leviticus 18 is an array of whether it's sexual sins or just moral issues. And so the verse I just read is in this list. And to conclude this list, verse 29, whoever does any of these abominations, those persons who do so shall be cut off from among their people. Now, something more explicit than that, turn to chapter 20 of Leviticus and look at verse 13. Leviticus 20 and verse 13. This spells it out plain. If there is a man who lies with a male as those who lie with a woman, both of them have committed a detestable act, they shall surely be put to death. So there's the law on sodomy. It was a capital offense. And so did the Gibeonites, they deserved death. So this was not vigilanteism, this was proper that they should die. Now, what about for rape? Turn to Deuteronomy 22, and I think Freddie alluded to this passage on Sunday. We didn't actually have the citation, but this is the one I think that he was calling to his mind. Deuteronomy 22, starting in verse 25. Actually, let's start in verse 23. If there is a girl who is a virgin engaged to a man, and another man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death, the girl, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man because he has violated his neighbor's wife. So you get the idea that it was consensual, and she did not cry, whether the cry would have been rape or stop or whatever. She was consenting to this act, and so therefore the law said, you stone them both. All right? Now, verse 25, but if in the field the man finds the girl who is engaged, and the man forces her, my version reads, forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lies with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the girl. There is no sin in the girl worthy of death, for just as a man rises against his neighbor and murders him, so is this case. When he found her in the field, the engaged girl cried out, but there was no one to save her. Now, it's not exactly the situation we have in Judges 19 through 21. But I have no trouble in my mind believing that this concubine was not a willing participant to this gang rape of these sodomites. And so, whether their action was sodomy, which they, if they had done that against the Levite, which is what they wanted, that would have been worthy of death. This case, they abused this woman. The group of them, and the text was clear, all night long they ravished her and raped her, and she died the next morning. That also is a capital offense or a capital crime. So there are two citations in the law that deal with the action that took place here in this second appendix. Yes. Yes, that's correct. When they said, bring the Sodomites out to us, and when we put them to death, Benjamin refused. That was not an unjustified demand. They needed to be put to death because of these statutes that we just read. That's a good point, Freddie. Okay, here's where we were on Sunday. This is the civil war in Israel. So at this point, Israel, they all gathered at Mizpah, 400,000 soldiers. And the Levite described his episode in Gibeah. And he was trying to get Israel up to date on the events, if you will. We sort of called into mind Sunday. He wasn't exactly, I'm not saying he was guilty of lying or anything, but the way he portrayed the event, I think, left some doubt as to his honesty, yes, whether whether he gave the concubine over or the old man, the old Levite, did, and he stood there and didn't do anything about it, but he left the implication that they came in and took her, which is not the case. They gave her over. They sacrificed this poor woman to this gang rape. So we talked about that. And then Israel decided, okay, we're going to have to go up against Benjamin. And so this was all covered on Sunday. They're going to go to war over this. And Benjamin had 26,000 soldiers in their force. And again, Israel had 400,000. So they did demand Gibeon sodomites be handed over. And Benjamin not only did not hand them over, but they rose to their defense. And they're prepared to go to battle over this, which, of course, was the wrong decision to make. Okay. Now, starting in verse 17, this gets us to question 16. We'll look at the battle in three stages, verses 17 through the end of the chapter. It's a large section of text, and we can look at the battle altogether. First stage, or the first day, let's say day number one. Let's do it this way, verses 18 through 23. How did the battle go the first day? No, yes, not good for Israel. Let's see, verse 18. The sons of Israel arose, went up to Bethel, and they inquired of God and said, "Who shall go up first for us to battle?" And as usually the case, and we've seen this before in the book of Judges, which tribe is always mentioned first? Judah. Judah will go first. So Judah would lead into battle. And so they did that. And verse 20, they went out arrayed for battle. Verse 21, though, what did Benjamin do the first day? Killed 22,000 Israelites on the first day. So how did Israel react to that? They just saw 22,000 of their men just wiped out. It's like that. Well, they retreated, didn't they? They fell back. They mourned their losses. You think they had any doubts or questions in their mind? I'd imagine they would have. So, verse 23, they went up and wept before the Lord until evening and inquired of the Lord. What's the obvious question? Should we do this again? Or are we just once and done and we'll forget about it? So shall we again draw near for battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin? And what did the Lord say? Yes. So the answer was yes. So that's the first day. 22,000 lost their lives. Now, the second day, or stage 2, verses 24 through 28. Here's the next day. Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah the second day, verse 25. What happens this time? 18,000. So that's so far a total of 40,000 Israelites. That's one-tenth of their force has been wiped out by the Benjamites. Then again, verse 26, all the sons of Israel and all the people went up and came to Bethel and wept. So again, they retreat. They mourn their losses. And they do something else the second day that they didn't do the first day. Okay, verse 26, they offer burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And something else is different about their inquiry. They inquired the first day. I mean, it says that, but there's something different about this time. What do they have with them this time? They have the Ark of the Covenant, and who else is there? All right, Phinehas is there. Now, who's Phinehas? Grandson, the grandson of Aaron. Son of, was it Eleazar? All right. So they used the ark to inquire of God whether to continue the battle. Now, just a side note here. I think this is another indication that may give us a clue as to the date of this story. Not that we have to know for certain when it was in terms of the story of the judges. But Phinehas began serving as the high priest before Joshua's death. Joshua 22 tells us that. So if Phinehas is mentioned now, we know that this story won't get tacked on the end of, say, Samson's story, because that would make Phineas about 300-something years old, and that's not possible, obviously. So, to me, this is an indication that this is early on in the days of the judges. I can't say for sure when, but that's at least the way it seems to me. So, they use Phineas in his priestly duties, and he inquires, verse 28, "Shall I yet again go out to battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease?" This time, the Lord's answer is a little different. It's the same one that the Lord said yes, but then what's the different part? All right, tomorrow you're going to win. Now, you can read a lot of commentaries and men's thoughts as, okay, if Benjamin's guilty in this, and they were defending men who needed to die, why would God have let 40,000 Israelites die the first 2 days of battle and then deliver them on the third day? Okay, this is a time of unfaithfulness in Israel. Perhaps God took issue with how they inquired of him the first couple of days. They did inquire of him, but and as Doug points out, perhaps it has to do with the overall unfaithfulness of the period, and maybe this was a judgment of God before he would relent and let them defeat Benjamin. This is all speculative. But for whatever reason, God in his wisdom, he let 40,000 Israelites perish the first 2 days of battle, and then finally he says, all right, tomorrow you will conquer Benjamin, you will overcome them in battle. And so there is some assurance, if you will. So now we come to the biggest section of text here, what we're calling stage three or day three. This starts in verse 29. What change in strategy do you see from the first 2 days to this day? Just go out and line up and let's have it out. But the third day, they're going to employ a different strategy. They're going to set up an ambush. Some military minds call this a pincer movement. We're going to have a small force out here to draw them out of the city, or maybe it's the main force, but we've got some men in hiding who will come in behind them once they've fled the city, and that opens up the city for us, and we can then surround them on both sides, plus take the city. And that's how it was going to work out. So, a different tactic this time. They put 10,000 in hiding for an ambush, it seems from the text, and they met Benjamin as before, and still, how many lost their lives this time? Okay, 30 more died, and that was to make Benjamin think what? Well, this is just like the first 2 days. I mean, they keep doing this, we'll go through the whole bunch of them before too much longer. So, Israel then feigns retreat. They start to run. Benjamin does what? They take up the chase, just like the first 2 days, which is just what Israel wanted, to set the trap for this ambush. Draw Benjamin out of the city. And then when Benjamin pursued in confidence, the 10,000, and it appears where the text reads, attack the exposed or the forfeited city, if you will, the abandoned city. And Israel then would stop fleeing, turn around and face Benjamin, and then Benjamin's caught. And there was a signal that Israel had amongst themselves. That is to say, a signal for the main body that went out first to meet Benjamin. When they saw something, when they saw the smoke rising from the city, that was their clue that the ambush unit had attacked the city, started to burn it, and then they would turn in on Benjamin and get this force surrounded. So when they saw the rising smoke from Gibeah, that was the signal to turn on Benjamin. Then Benjamin lost their courage. And how many did they lose? 25,000, it says. That's in verse 35. 25,100. And there's some rounding of the numbers here, apparently, because you look at verse 46. So all of Benjamin who fell that day were 25,000 men. So we can't get specific with the numbers. You add up the numbers in verses 44, 45, and 46. Well, 44 and 45, you'll get 25,000. And of that amount, there was 26,000 to begin with, wasn't there? Yeah, Yes. Well, I was working about the numbers there just for a second. Why there's a difference in the numbers. But yes, the Lord did defeat them. We certainly understand that. That's not a problem. But of this Benjamite force, how many escaped? All right, 600 escaped from the battle and went running into the wilderness for cover. And apparently that's all the ones that survived this battle, these 600 Benjamites. Okay. Now that's pretty much the story of the war, all of chapter 20. That takes us all the way through question 16 on page 42. Is there anything that anybody had that we did not discuss or cover in specific that you want to comment on? Anybody? It's a pretty straightforward story. Okay, now we come to the last chapter, which is chapter 21. And that concludes this second appendix. It was right to judge Benjamin, but now what's Israel's concern? We've lost a tribe. We've just about decimated an important part of our family. Yes, they would have. They would have done that, Freddie. You are correct. So before the Civil War, before they went to battle, Israel made a covenant amongst themselves. And when I say Israel, that does not include Benjamin. I mean all the other tribes. What was the decision they made? Okay. There's nobody here who is to give their daughters to the Benjamite men. Yes, they put themselves under a curse. So that's the covenant that they made. But then after the war, as we put it on the chart, the reality sets in. What did they realize? Well, we've made this oath, and now we see how the battles turned out. We've got a problem. As much as they wanted to defeat Benjamin, which they did, they now wanted to do what? We want to save the tribe from extinction. We don't want the name of Benjamin to just disappear into antiquity and we lose this, we lose a whole tribe. So, to show their remorse, this is verses 5 through 7 of chapter 21. Well, let's see. Let's look at their words starting in verse 2. The people came to Bethel and sat there before God until evening and lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And they said, "Why, O Lord God of Israel, has this come about in Israel so that one tribe should be missing today in Israel?" And it came about the next day that the people arose early and built an altar there and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So they're taking this issue to the Lord. Then the sons of Israel said, now here's how they are going to solve all this. "Who is there among all the tribes of Israel who did not come up in the assembly to the Lord?" Now, that was the assembly at Mizpah back in chapter 20 when they all gathered as one man and the Levite told his story. They said, "Is anybody didn't show up?" The end of verse 5, "For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord at Mizpah, saying, 'He shall surely be put to death.'" So they wanted everybody involved, anybody who didn't come at that assembly, we're going to have to deal with them too. All right, was there anybody that didn't show up? Verse 6, "The sons of Israel were sorry for their brother Benjamin and said, 'One tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord not to give them any of our daughters in the marriage?' So what one is there of the tribes of Israel who did not come to the Lord at Mizpah? Behold, no one had come from the camp of Jabesh Gilead to the assembly." Now, earlier in some of the stories of the judges, the specific stories, where did we say Gilead was? Anybody remember? It's the east side of Jordan. Sometimes it's specific and referring to the tribe area of Gad. And in some Bible passages, it refers to all three areas, Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, or the half of Manasseh plus Reuben and Gad's territory. And that's all referred to as Gad. But I don't have a map on the chart here, but if you have a map in your Bible, you'll see that the city of Jabesh Gilead is in the tribal area of Gad. Sometimes it's called Gilead on your map. But no one came from Jabesh-Gilead. And so they said, all right, this gives us an out. So already they've concocted what plan? First off, they're going to go against Jabesh-Gilead. Why? Because they didn't come participate in the meeting. So that takes care of that. But since we're going to have that issue, we kill those men and the women who had lain with the man, or those who were not virgins, that would leave the virgins of Jabesh-Gilead, and we're going to give them to the Benjamites. So that would solve both the issues. Well, they were going to take them. Give or take, whatever you want to call it. And to be true, that they would not give them because of their oath. But, I mean, it's tomato, tomato. It's pretty much the same idea. That was their thinking anyway. So this is a city in Gilead that's east of the Jordan River. And so Israel sent 12,000 foot soldiers, or 12,000 soldiers, to strike the city. And you'll see there in verse 10, strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, with the women and the little ones. What about that? They're going to kill babies. And this is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every man and every woman who has lain with a man. So judgment. And verse 12 tells us that they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by living with him. That, of course, is a reference to sexual activity. They had not lain with a man. And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh. Now, what's at Shiloh again? Well, that's where the tabernacle was, and perhaps the ark was there as well. So that's where God's house had been set up. We'd seen that before in some of our stories. So they bring them there, and this is going to be done for the Benjamites, who came just within a whisker of being exterminated becoming extinct. So they captured 400 young virgins and brought them to their camp. They were given to the 600 refugees, and already you can see what's the problem. That's not enough. That was still going to leave 200 Benjamites wifeless, if you will. Now, as much as they were upset at the Benjamites for not handing over the Gibeonites, the Sodomites in Gibeah, they are just as concerned about protecting and preserving Benjamin. And so they're really, I see them, they're just really trying hard to make sure that this tribe does not go extinct. They're thinking of everything that they can think of. The Bible doesn't say, but it just strikes me that they hopefully thought that there'd be enough in Jabesh-Gilead to take care of all the Benjamites, and that'd be the end of it, but they didn't find that many. They still had 200 that they had to provide for, if we can use that terminology. So they were trying their best to find a way to keep Benjamin from becoming extinct. They didn't want a tribe to be blotted out from Israel, but at the same time, they wanted to remain true to their vow. So they're in this Cap 22 situation. How can they be true to this vow? And after all, making a vow to the Lord, what's the importance of that? I mean, you keep a vow. They don't want to go back on their word. But at the same time, they still want to take care of Benjamin. So that's what they're trying to bridge here, these two extremes. So now we come to the solution for the 200 that were left. This takes us to verse 13. Well, actually, I'll take that back. Verse 19. Okay. Make sure I don't skip anything here. Yeah, verse 15, they were sorry for Benjamin. That evidences their feelings about Benjamin. And verse 17, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin. We can't let them go away to nothing. But verse 18, we cannot give them wives of our daughters, for we had sworn. Okay, so what's their solution now? They didn't get enough women from Jabesh-Gilead. Okay. We're going to have another ambush. All right. And the feast was held where? in Shiloh. It seems to be an annual feast at Shiloh. I don't know that we're given the reason for the feast, are we? It just says it's a feast. We have some directions there in verse 19, the north side of Bethel. And at this feast, it was rejoicing for some reason. Maybe it was crop related or whatever the issue was. There was feasting there, and time for merrymaking. Well, okay. All right. It could be. If this story is before Jephthah, it wouldn't work. But if it was after Jephthah, it could be in connection with the feast for Jephthah's daughter. That's certainly a possibility. For whatever the reason, they're feasting, and so they told the 200 Benjamites, well, you go in the vineyards and you just sit there and wait. And then what are they supposed to do? You go catch you a wife. When they come out to dance, you just find one that you like, and you go grab her, and you take her back to, you go take her back to your to the Benjamite territory. And that's how we're going to solve this problem of a lack of wives for the 200 that were left. So, what do you think about that idea? That's rather unique, isn't it? But now there's going to be one more problem to deal with still. And the Israelites anticipated this from the part of the fathers or brothers of the, shall we say, captured females. Pardon? Yeah, the oath is coming into play here. Verse 21, you're to watch and behold, if the daughters of Shiloh come out to take part in the dances, then you shall come out of the vineyards, and each of you shall catch his wife from the daughters of Shiloh. And let's see, by the way, Shiloh is in Ephraim. That's in Ephraim's territory. So you'll catch you a wife and take her back to the land of Benjamin. Now verse 22. It shall come about when their fathers or their brothers, if they come to complain to us about this activity, what were they going to be told? What was Israel going to tell the Ephraimite brothers and fathers of the captured? Be kind. Okay. Yeah, my version says, we shall say to them, give them to us voluntarily. Well, that is to say, look, they've been taken. Just let them go. We did not take for each man of Benjamin a wife in battle, referring to the previous battle at Jabesh-Gilead, nor did you give them. By that they mean you didn't give them voluntarily, or else you would now be guilty. Well, guilty of what? Of that vow, that they would have broken the vow. So, could capture on me and get my charts caught up here. The Ephraimites would have objected on the basis of the vow, or perhaps just this was sort of barbaric behavior, going out and grabbing a wife. So Israel would encourage the Ephraimites to let these daughters go because not enough wives that were found in battle at Jabesh-Gilead, and the reasoning was these daughters had not been given, per se, per the vow, so they could be accused of that. And Ephraim would not bear guilt regarding the vow. So if you were an Ephraimite father or brother, you think that'd make you happy? Would that satisfy you? Well, it wouldn't me. I'm drawing a parallel here. This to me seems to be a rather legalistic answer. Well, they weren't given. Well, that may be so. Like a caveman dragging his wife away. Now, I've got some New Testament passages on the chart that have nothing to do with this story, but Jesus dealt with some of this kind of thinking from the Pharisees in the days of the New Testament. And when men use sophistry or they play games with words to sort of get around something, is that on the up and up? I mean, it's not. Not at all. And we shouldn't be that way. at all. Matthew 15 is one example, and Matthew 23, those passages. And there's more than those two, but that sort of gives us the idea of how they got around a sticky situation. Legalistically, they had not been given, but when they say in verse 22, well, just let us have them voluntarily, that's, in a manner of speaking, that's a giving. You know, don't pursue the matter. Don't call our hand on it. Just let them go. They were, after all, they were taken, or they were grabbed, captured. Yeah, I mean, they're already gone. And so how does this episode conclude? Verse 23, sons of Benjamin did so, took the wives according to their number from those who danced, whom they carried away. And they went and returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the cities and lived in them. Was it strange for a woman not to know her husband before marriage anyway? No, it wasn't strange. It was very common. So it's not the fact that well, these are complete strangers. Well, that was usually the case with marriages in the days of the Old Testament. So that's not the point of objection. The point of objection is how these women were taken. It was sort of schemed and worked out in advance, then this legalistic definition, if you will, or wordplay here to make amends for it. So the 200 Benjamites did as they'd been instructed. They take them back. What happened now to unified Israel? Verse 24. They've been unified since they've been called together. When the Levite cut the concubine up in pieces, sent it out through all Israel, they came together three times in chapter 20. They came together as one man on this issue. So they've been unified on this. All right, now the whole situation has been resolved. What about unified Israel now? Verse 24. They disperse. They go back to their home tribal territories. So they did not leave, as it said. Let's see, that was back in chapter 20. Let me find it right quick. Yeah, verse 8. Not one of us will go to his tent, nor will any of us return to his house. We're going to stay here until we get this whole situation resolved, which they did. And now unified Israel will be dismissed, and they all go home. Now that's pretty much the appendix, the second appendix. We have one more statement to conclude the book of Judges. What's the closing comment? All right. How many times have we seen this statement? Well, there's four altogether. Three. This one, 21:25, 17:6, 18:1, and 19:1. There was no king in Israel. Again, illustrating a lack. Now, again, was there a king in Israel? Yes, God's the king. They should have recognized God's rule as the king. But it meant an earthly king when they couldn't see. And so a lack of, say, centralized, objective authority that would have maybe brought an end to all this lawlessness. As we've been through this entire book, all these stories, what have we seen? What's been the predominant story? What have we seen over and over again? Unfaithfulness to God. They would go chasing after idols. And finally, just to do a short review, God would say, in essence, what? All right, well, I'll let you go then. You're going to act like that? You suffer the consequences of your actions, and so they would be delivered over to an impressive nation until what would happen? Israel would do what? They'd cry. They would cry to God for help. Deliver us, save us, redeem us from all this. And God would hear their cry. So, again, this showed the mercy and the patience of God. He was justified in sending them away to captivity, if you will, or to oppression because of their unfaithfulness. But just as much as God would be right in doing that, He was just as right in His love and His mercy to want to do what? To bring them back, to forgive them based on genuine repentance. Then He would send the deliverer. And so we see this cycle over, and we went through all those stories. And the conclusion of the book is so appropriate, it's so apt. There was no king in Israel. The reason for all this unfaithfulness is that everyone just did what they wanted to. No objective rule. And as we've made common in the past, this statement, everyone did what was right in his own eyes, that sounds like whose culture? Ours. Sounds just like ours. Absolutely does. Okay. Anybody have any closing comments or questions with respect to the judges' lessons? We've been through all the stories that's in the book. Okay. Maybe this was in commemoration of that. Okay. Exodus, what chapter was that? All right, Exodus 15. Miriam danced with the daughters. Perhaps this was a commemoration of that. The text doesn't say, but if for some unnamed reason, the daughters would come and dance at this very festive occasion, and Israel knew about it. It was going to happen. It was an annual thing. So they said, when that happens, go grab you a woman for a wife. Yes. Yes, it did. Absolutely. Good point. Very good, Rob, because when they got their kings, literal kings on the thrones, what happened? They still did stuff like this. They still would disobey and displease God. And sometimes the king were the... That's a very good point. Very good point. There were some good kings, though, but the vast majority of them were just wicked to the core. Okay. In a couple of minutes we've got left, turn back to page 3 if you have your folders with you. We're going to start the story of Ruth. And we'll make some of these points again on Sunday. But just the information on pages 3 and 4 that we went through when we introduced this material back the first Sunday of September when the quarter began. As bad as Judges is with respect to the unfaithfulness and all the sin, how refreshing is Ruth's story? Beautiful story. Very, very wholesome. It's such a refreshing story to read. Some things we could learn in the story of Ruth. When everyone else around you is not doing right, not doing well, is it possible for even one to do right? It's possible. I think we see that in Boaz. He was a good man. No, he didn't get his wife the way that these Benjamites did. You're right. What does Ruth impress us with? Now, where's she come from, by the way? She's a Moabitess. She's not an Israelite. But what do you see in her character, even as a Moabitess? And plug it into the judges' days, the days of the judges. Well, I tell you, she's got faith in her that even the Hebrews don't have. She showed more faith in Jehovah that even the Israelites did not have. So it's obvious that when Elimelech's family, and that's the family in the story of Ruth, when they go to Moab and Naomi and Elimelech's two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, when they meet Orpah and Ruth and they marry them, but what's not stated, judging from Ruth's own words in chapter 1 plus her actions throughout the rest of the book, what happened to Ruth when she came into Elimelech's family? She was converted to Jehovah. I'm convinced of that. She had been taught. She knew something about Naomi's people, Naomi's God, because she said, where you go, I go. Your people will be my people and your God will be my God. Now she learned something. We don't know what she was taught, but she learned something about that. And she showed more faith and more conviction than the vast majority of the Israelites in these stories of the judges. So it's just a refreshing, easy read. You can read this book in probably less than 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Just read right through it. It's a great story. And we'll devote 3 class periods to these 4 chapters starting on Sunday. So come prepared on Sunday morning, Lord willing, to do lesson 19, which is Ruth, the first chapter. All right. Any comments from anybody? Questions? Yes, Charles. Right. There were good Benjamites. Very, very good point to make. All right. Well, we'll pick up then with Ruth chapter 1 on Sunday morning. Lord willing, thank you for your good comments and your participation tonight.